Hello, and welcome to the Flickering Lights podcast. My name is Alex Lehman, and today I'm talking with Josh Trigg, writer and film director. Hey. And today today we're talking about your first feature film, Satu, Year of the Rabbit, which is, as we're recording now, hasn't been released, but it's almost finished with the post-production and everything.
Correct. That is true. It is almost finished. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much finished. It's been submitted to the festivals, so we're kind of waiting now. There's like tiny bits of polishing, like really, like tiny, tiny little silly little things, really, more than anything. But yeah, it's done essentially. So it's off, and we're just waiting to hear back from the festivals now.
Hmm. Obviously, the people involved in the making of the movie, as well as me, and I guess some other people as well, you've shown the film. But what is it like, releasing it to a wider audience, or like sending it to people who don't know?
Like, what does it feel like?
Yeah.
I think, it's one of those things. It's like each group of people in each kind of stage brings something different to the table. And it's kind of what you take from it, right? So for me, I just want people to see it now. It's really important that the people in my local peripheral, in like my peripherals, other filmmakers and peers, see it. And I'm kind of interested in what they have to say about it. But yeah, I'm excited to have a premiere, excited to do some screenings and just like get a gauge on it, you know, and see what people think of the film, really. I think that's what I'm most curious about. I don't really care too much if they kind of like it or not, I guess. I think because it is what it is and I'm kind of happy with it. So I just want to know people's opinions. I'm curious how people interpret things. You know, I think that's always an interesting thing to kind of be part of.
Mm. Obviously, this film was shot on location in Laos. And I think I've seen years ago a very early iteration of this script, like a long time ago. Which I think was basically also a sort of road movie type.
Yeah.
I know I saw it like an early... So can you talk about the process of writing the script? Why did you want to make a movie set in this location? And how was this sort of getting from like very early ideas about this movie to the thing that you actually shot?
Right. So yeah, I mean, I think ultimately this was I don't know if this happens to everyone, but it changed over time and it morphed and it turned into its own thing. Obviously through the process it naturally does that, but in terms of writing it, it was the second feature that I had written. I think really looking back, the first feature I wrote was a training kind of process, really, more than anything, and I think a lot of themes I was exploring in there ended up getting carried over. I'm always been looking for a film that I can make for a long, long time, right? So I happened to be making some documentaries out in Laos in 2019, in October 2019. And I just fell in love with the people and the country and just some of these locations. I was just like, you could set a movie here, it'd be amazing. Obviously, it's cheaper to make a film there as well. So that was a big part of it, because I knew ultimately I was going to have to fund this myself if I was going to make it happen. And that was kind of part of the decision. But really, I kind of fell in love with the place, fell in love with these characters I met, the team I worked with out there on these documentaries, which were commercially funded documentaries, kind of crossover charity / commercial docs for Toyota, but about classical musicians in Southeast Asia. The team out there we were working with, they were incredibly passionate about narrative. They only really wanted to make narrative, but just like us, you know, wanted to make narrative. And so that drew me to them, and I thought this could be possible, you know, if I can get enough money in the bank, I could make this. And so I wrote it over the pandemic, and then, you know, everyone had to find something to do, right? So I just jumped back on that. I'd started writing it before the pandemic, you know, but it hit and I was like, this is perfect. This is perfect. The world's ending. This is great. Now I can write my script, basically.
Well, you also shot this during the pandemic, so tell me about how that experience was like.
That was, as you can imagine, a bit of a curse and a plus as well. So technically a nightmare in terms of production, producing it, because I produced it myself, like an idiot, but I had a lot of help as well from this incredible team in Laos who took so much weight off of me, obviously out there at the physical principal photography side of things, which made it all really great. They were incredible. But the logistics of getting a team, you know, I had a couple of my sound man, my god of sound, Emanuele from here in London, and my DOP, James Chegwin, come over as well. And we were the core of the kind of creative crew, if that makes sense. And so we flew over there in January last year, 2022, when Thailand and Laos was all in lockdown still. And I think each step of the way, I wasn't sure that we'd ever get from A to B. You know, even getting into Thailand was really hard. Getting all the documents in time, we'd only just, like, everything was by the skin of our teeth. Like, we shouldn't have made it into Thailand in the first place because they were just going back into a heavier lockdown. We were like the last people to get through this scheme on the last deadline to get over there, to do a quarantine there, then to go into Laos and do the same thing. And so it was technically very difficult and costly, but it meant we had free rein, if that makes sense. Like, when we had a lot of access. Yeah, we had so much access, because once you were through and on the other side, we really had we just had free rein of the place. There were no tourists. It was an empty country. That was cool. Yeah. You know,
how long did principal photography shooting last?
So we shot 26 days over 6 weeks. Okay. And we had 2 weeks there for pre-production. All the pre-production was pretty much done remotely. And the 2 weeks there, 10 of those days were done in quarantine. And then the last few days were literally us running around like idiots, trying to make everything work, from like emergency location recces to emergency rehearsals and stuff. Essentially, I also had to run around for like 2 days straight of that time restyling everyone, because I was not happy with the styling, basically. And it was just something we just weren't able to put together in time, and what they had put together, it was just not working. So I went to every single like secondhand shop, thrift shop, random shop, t-shirt shops, malls, whatever, every market over 2 days in between all this stuff, finding the perfect outfits for the two main characters, because it was just none of it was gelling. And you know, you got to sit with these characters for the whole time. I have to sit for 2 months with these guys, and I can't be looking at them going, I hate what they're wearing. I'm just a bit anal with that stuff, but if it didn't look right, it would bother me for the whole. And it I just couldn't have it. So the clothes are really simple. But dude, I went to every shop, and the only place that had just a plain stripy t-shirt was this random shop that I found the t-shirts that the kid Satu wears. Yeah, stupid amount of time went into that.
So you brought over the sound engineer and the DOP. Yep. What was your crew like other than that when you were shooting in Laos?
I've got hot chocolate, so if I'm a bit slow to respond, I'm having a drink of my hot chocolate.
Sure.
So the team that I took out with me, what was your question? Sorry.
What was your crew like on set besides the DOP and the sound person?
I was distracted by my hot chocolate. I was like, oh God, it's not getting cold. So the team in Laos are incredible, extremely creative, extremely talented, and I think just so quick to learn. And so there's two production companies in the whole country. So if that gives a bit of context to kind of what you're up against, you know, that and there's only like three cinemas, for example. So I think what was interesting to me, that we already knew a few of them, you know, that's why we went to it. We felt confident about those guys. And
so you had local professionals.
All local. And we brought one focus, but we've brought a really talented focus puller from Bangkok. So I work a lot in Southeast Asia in general, and Bangkok, they're very well trained. And so we brought a first AC, a focus puller from Bangkok, who was extremely experienced in pulling on film, and you know, we shot everything on 16mm film, so we couldn't have anyone, you know, mess that up. And so yeah, we brought P. Kai over from Bangkok. It was amazing. Actually, on that note, before moving on, because of that setup, we were able to train people in Laos. So we were training up kind of, you know, early 20s, first ACs on how to pull on film. So they know how to load film cameras, they know how to work with film cameras. And so they actually, after we shot Satu, they were able to take on a documentary from Spain all on 16mm because they actually had that skill set. So we trained people up there as well, which feels awesome. You know, like that feels like a reward in itself, just knowing that you're having a positive impact on the film community, you know. I think that was, feels good.
You actually gave me a nice bridge there, because the next thing I want to continue on is, obviously you shot this film on film, on actual film, on 16mm. Yes. I assume if you wanted to, you easily could have shot it digitally. So why did you make that creative choice?
So yeah, I think, let me try and keep this short, because there's a lot, you know, we've got Aries and, you know, we could have shot it digitally. And I think considering, I'm sure we're going to talk about like budget constraints and things like that. I just felt like, firstly, I love film. I shoot a lot on film. I've always loved film. You know, we can talk about just the history of cinema and da 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 da. It's hard not to love film. I'm quite confident with film because we shoot a lot of commercial work on film as well. I just never saw myself shooting on anything else. But I think also, if you're gonna throw everything into the kind of like wind and see where it lands, I think why not go the extra mile and shoot it on film? We didn't see any of the rushes until we got back. We weren't able to do dailies. It was a financial constraint, but it was also a kind of pandemic constraint, and we just had to make like smart decisions, right? So I think it forces you to shoot in a certain way, and it's a way of focusing your vision, which I think is really important for a first time film as well. I think just make decisions and know that they're the right ones and commit to it. But also I think just production value. I think anyone can go out and shoot anything on anything, and I think that it shows a level of skill and commitment to the craft, but it also adds production value. For me, suddenly the film is just worth so much more. I could have shot the fuck out of it on digital and, you know, edit in a million different ways, but instead I had to just like commit to my vision and learn my craft. It's like proper film school, you know, actually just going and making a film on film. I think there's no other way to learn, really.
Yeah, because I was watching it last night, and it felt almost like a retro movie or like something that was shot in the 70s. It's very strange, because it doesn't feel like, it doesn't, like, I was like, this doesn't fit in with like the like films that you see today, because it just looks so radically different.
It looks like an old movie. And so that was also something I kind of got obsessed by, this idea, like starting to spend a lot of time understanding the history of cinema in the region and in Laos specifically. I feel like really nothing that feels classic has been made for a long time, if ever. And I kind of had this idea in my head. I worked so closely with them out in Laos to make sure that this was a Lao film. It's not for anyone else. You know, just the themes and the characters and what they're going through and everything. Just, I wanted it to be a film for people from Laos. And I think that got in my head that maybe like I should approach, I wanted to approach it in the end, like visually and mentally, really, as like this, like maybe the like a classic that hasn't, that maybe no one, like a film, maybe they found it, you know, from 40 years ago and no one knew it existed. Like, just what would that maybe look like? And I think, yeah, that's kind of what I was aiming for in the end, was just like the first classic. That's kind of how I was approaching it. Because we have lots of that over here, you know, in Europe and in the States.
You mentioned I forgot what I was going to ask.
That gives me a chance to drink my hot chocolate. That's fine. Sure. I don't want it to get cold. It's sure, delicious. Sure. It's like a salted caramel white chocolate, hot chocolate.
Delicious. Now I was going to ask you, you mentioned that you didn't do dailies when you shot this film. So that means mm-hmm. that when you sat on the plane back to London, you had no idea what the film, what you actually had.
Yeah, so we didn't see any of it. I think, okay, so basically we refurbished this old French cinema camera. It was it's an Arton LTR, and we put a lot of time and money into getting that how we wanted it to kind of work. It broke down 10 days into shooting. We had to get a camera driven up from Bangkok, smuggled over the border because you weren't allowed it over the border. So we had to get this camera smuggled over the border, an Arri SR3, which we switched out. So we didn't even have time to get it video tapped. So I didn't even have a video tap, which means I didn't even have visuals. So me and the DOP were just communicating through, obviously I can look through the viewfinder, but we're just communicating in we worked together a lot. So I was really comfortable with that, but still it's a lot to just like do 10 days shooting and not see any of it, like even like through a little monitor. So after the 10 days, then I had a monitor and I could see what we were shooting. You can't even see if the stuff's sharp or in focus on those monitors, because they're just like, you know, like it looks like VHS, right, almost. So but it's a good way to get a vibe of it. So I kind of got an idea off of those bits, but then you don't know what's going to come back and be just fucked, right? So that's what you want dailies. You get a vibe for people like, oh, we should have covered this one like this, da, 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 da. And you can kind of amend as you go a little bit. We had to just get everything right. And I would say like 98%, 99% of it was good, you know? So that meant that the film could be cut how it was kind of supposed to be cut. But yeah, I stayed for a couple of weeks in Thailand afterwards just to like fucking decompress basically before we flew back. And that's when I got like very low res files sent over, because it's 8 terabytes of material, right? So very low res, and I was like, oh, okay, it exists, it's not fucked. Like my whole life has gone into this for 4 years, and I just didn't want that to be all destroyed, you know, because we had someone borrow the camera recently for a personal shoot, and they shot 3 rolls of film and they were all fucked,
right?
So we shot 72 rolls of film and they were all fine. they had 100% fail rate, we had 100% success rate on way more film. So I want to say it was luck, it was skill, dedication, focus from my team, and really talented professionals that went out of the way to make sure it was gonna work, you know.
So in terms of hours, how much material is we talking about?
It's like 11 and a half hours.
Okay.
So not much, really.
Yeah, the movie's just I think the final runtime is just shy of 90 minutes.
Yeah,
how's the editing
it's 90,
process?
It's 90 minutes. Yeah, man, cut it all together. Longest, do a kind of long cut. Cut it. It just slowly whittles down, doesn't it? You tighten things up and you make something a bit longer here, make something a bit tighter here, cut out a scene, put it back in, you know? But I had to do... I did the first 7 cuts myself because it's also in another language, and I felt like I was the most... I knew the script really well, and I kind of almost know most of it in the Lao language as well now. I feel like I'm able to, I was best placed to put that together. So I put that together, and then for the last kind of couple of cuts, I brought in a long standing friend and close friend and editor of mine, Nick Saunders, who came in and helped me out with the last push. And I really needed those eyes, because he was like, it very quickly was like, move this here, move that here, move that here, done, amazing, we can move on. Like, just, it was like I assembled it, then he edited it, you know. That's what it felt like, these last the finishing touches of that. And yeah, man, and it was like two hours 10 minutes, and then it's a 90 minute movie with, and then credits on top of that, so it's like an hour and 40 total ish, which is a nice length, you know, I think, for a first feature as well. But yeah, man, that took time, especially in another language, you know. Slows you down getting interpreted.
What were the challenges of shooting a film in a language that you do not speak?
I think you have to be someone that loves that to want to do a great job of it. Otherwise, it can fall flat. So I think for me, I've always been obsessed with alphabets and languages, and I've just always enjoyed studying it, not to much more of a degree than, you know, I, for example, tried to teach myself hieroglyphics when I was 15 for like years, studied Japanese on my own, so I could read hiragana and katakana, Saxon runes. Like, I was obsessed with just alphabets and other languages. And I think if you like that kind of thing, then you have the kind of, I guess, willpower to see something through like that. I also like films in other languages. It just looks and sounds cool to me and makes it more exciting. I'm inspired by other cultures, and I think that pulled me through. But the challenges, I would say, are it's just time consuming, you know, because also like things interpret differently, and you have to have an incredible team. I completely trust this incredible film director in Lao, who produced the movie for me out there, who was helping me with, him and his sister were helping me like convert the script and stuff, and they're just really talented. And I think it comes down to their incredible commitment to the story as well, that I was able to pull that off. But then falling in love with the culture as well, that really helps, you know. And it's just a matter of time, and then studying it, you know, like, it's interesting. Why not study a language to make a film? I mean, awesome, super fun. Yeah,
I think one of the most striking things in the film is like the landscapes.
Oh yeah, man, it's the most beautiful country I've ever been to. It's really like, it's just, yeah, you have to go. You have to go there. It's more beautiful than that. That's the thing. We went in the dry season because it was like,
right,
it was kind of the only time we could do it. And when we went there to do the documentaries, it was like the height of this kind of very like green season. And it is just like, you can't believe it. You're just gobsmacked. You're like, how can a place like this on the planet exist? It's pure paradise. It's paradise. The people are beautifully human and just friendly and kind and warm, and it's just stunning, and it just blows your mind. I couldn't recommend it more. One of the most incredible places I've been to in the world. Yeah.
This is very much a shoot that you threw yourself into. How stressful were you during when you were shooting it? How stressed were you?
Very fucking stressed, man. It was finances, you know. Producing this myself was tough, like exec producing it myself, financing it. But managed to put it off. But that was the most stressful thing. Creatively, it's like, it's a joy, right? I mean, the only thing that was stressful is the finances. The creative side of it, actually shooting it, I had to really park that, because I was like, I'm not going through all this to like be affected by that. It affected me now and then, but I really had to just fucking park it and just be like, I'm here to make this. Now I have to make this, you know. This has to be.
So you didn't let that distract you while you were shooting it?
I couldn't. Mm. I think I had to like Iron Man mode that and just go, yep, cool, park it. I mean, people, you know, are in financial situations like this all the fucking time. You're not the only one, and I kind of just kept telling myself that, and it was too late, you know. I was there. It's like, I can't just like fucking run away, you know. So I was like, we're in it, we're doing it, we're here, let's make it. It's my lifelong dream, right, to make a feature movie, so a feature film. So I think just had to, like you said, throw yourself into it, and the making it is a joy. Even if something is stressful, it's not really stressful. It's just a puzzle, and puzzles are fun, you know. Like, that's it. Like, puzzles are great. So really, it's just finances. Everything else is just fun, and it should be fun, and should be approached with joy and kindness and understanding, and, you know, all those things are why I love the film, because I know I made it with that, with those at the front of my mind, and everyone that made it with me enjoyed it for those same reasons. There was a very much like a moral aspect to making this thing. It was like, we're doing this for the love of making films, and we're all going to have a lot of fun doing it. That was everybody on board, you know. Yeah, it's good. Stressful, though.
I can imagine. Obviously, people who know different things will watch it differently, but I knew how difficult the process was and how much stress it was. And it was just interesting watching the movie
blood,
and how...
sweat, and tears.
Yeah. But it's interesting how, like, the movie itself is kind of laid back, almost.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a road movie that it has some, you know, some scenes of heightened, you know, when they're getting chased by the police
and
stuff.
Yeah, there's some tension.
But a lot of it is... a lot of it's pretty, you know, laid back almost.
For sure.
It kind of goes at a pretty, like, you know, slow but brisk pace.
Yeah.
And you don't really, that, like, those elements definitely don't translate to the film, like the fact that it was...
And that's important to me to hear you say that, man, because I think I can't stress enough how hard that was. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but I know that you know how hard it was, and it really came down to the finances. But yeah, I didn't want to. When we were shooting, and I enjoyed that. You know, I had to enjoy it because I was like, well, what's the point? Otherwise, what's the point of all this? So I just really had to park it. But it's interesting you say that. I think in terms of the pacing and stuff, I think something I love about this film is that I think after a while you just kind of forget you're watching a film and you just. You're like, I'm just in Lao right now. And that is just exactly what I was going for. I don't know if you got that vibe, but you just find yourself at one point, I'm just like, oh, I'm just like in the jungle. And that's cool.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of very beautiful images in this film.
Man. Thank you very much.
Talking a bit more about the shooting aspect, obviously the two principal characters are Bo and Satu.
Satu.
And they were played, I don't know, but they were quite young. Like, obviously, the Satu is a young boy and she's, I don't know, a teenager.
Yep. So 12 and 18, but she plays like a 17-year-old.
Okay. Yeah, she looked younger. But what was that like working with such young actors for like most of the movie?
I mean, I think, you know, I know that you kind of know I have a history of. Working with kids, so I'm really comfortable with it. I mean, I've eldest of four, used to do these still shoots for my mum's kids clothing brand. Just really used to that. I don't find it difficult, and I think for me, you know, you find the right people, you don't really need to do much. You know, if it's like Satu is Satu, I didn't have to tell him to do anything. You know, really, you know, now and then I'd be like, so yeah, you know, oh fuck, I was nearly gonna ruin the whole story then, and just massive spoiler alert, but yeah, I'd just give him a direction, like, you know, your fucking rabbit's dead and you're sad, you know, how would you approach that, you know, basically. And you can speak to kids like adults, and you know, they'll respond. I think everyone treats them like, oh yeah, oh, so you're really sad now, you know, they don't want to hear that. Just blend in with them. I mean, I'm a big kid, so it's not hard for me to just be like, you know, get in that mode with them. It's just a game, that's all it is, and that's what filmmaking is, right? It's just a game. So just getting them on board with that mentality that we're just playing a game, and this is the story that we're telling to ourselves, it's easy. And he was amazing. He's just is who he is, and he just killed it. I mean, he's a great little actor. He's just smashes it out of the park. And Uko, who plays Bo, she's great, and she's like super multi talented. Does everything, dancing, you know, everything under the sun, and she just smashes it. Well, again, it was just really natural. And I think I love non actors, and you know, really these are non actors. They're not trained in any capacity. Maybe they did a bit of like plays at school or something. Satu, the actor's nick, like real name is Rat, and he has like this Facebook channel with his like brother in the village, and who's also in the film, who plays the other. Like the monk boy.
Oh, the monk boy. Okay,
yeah,
sure.
And he Yeah,
so man, it's the same one from the credits sequence.
Yeah, exactly, sure, from the credits sequence. They have their own little YouTube channel, Facebook channel, and they just come up with these random stories. And I just, this is how we got the gig, because it was just like, they're just making films on their own, and I was like, that's what I used to do. You know, it's just, they just love it, and they're just doing it. And it just goes to show that translates even at that age. Doesn't matter how old you are. Doesn't matter what you film it on. It's about how much you love the craft, you know? And I think that they were both, I love them both very much. I think they did so well. But patience and kindness and friendliness and all these things, even if you're not feeling like that inside, which at times I wasn't, you just got to remember to make it a fun experience. And I think that's really important when you're working with kids and young adults, you know? Yeah, that's nice. My answer. That is my answer.
Just looking a bit more broadly on the film, one of the things that is sort of when you're watching a film and thinking, what is this film about and what are the themes? Obviously, one of the things that came across very clearly is, you know, there's both the main characters have this lack of parents. Like her mom is gone, and she lives with her neglectful father. So to his parents, yep. We don't know where his father is, and his mom obviously left him at the monastery. Why was this something that you honed in on for both the characters, that they have like this similar thing that they lack?
So, I mean, it's just me dealing with my own stuff, right? And I think it's just a way to write scripts, is you work with stuff that you know. And I think some stories are universal. I don't have a dad, basically, and I just found that easy to write about. It's like, you think about this stuff your whole life, right? So it's easy to put this down on paper into another character. I approach both those characters as versions of me from the past, basically, emotionally, when it comes to like that part of the plot. They're both just kind of looking for the same thing, really, or dealing with it in different ways. Like Yuko's dealing with it by escaping, but Sati's dealing with it quite head on, and I think kids tend to do that. And when you grow up, you try, I think, at least I did, you try to find excuses and run away a bit, and inevitably you have to face it anyway. So I like the idea that a younger version of me is kind of almost helping an older version of me face the truths. And I think that is kind of what really happens between the two characters. They can almost be seen as the same character from two different points in time, in terms of their narrative arcs and stuff like that. But yeah.
Do you find it therapeutic to work through these kind of things through art?
For sure, man. And I think, like, ultimately, it's funny because there was some meme going around of Steven Spielberg saying... I don't know if you've seen this one, like Steven Spielberg saying that he something about, you know, I use film as my therapy. I don't need to go to therapy because I use films as my therapy. And I thought, oh shit, I should just go to therapy. I thought, this is really fucked up. And
it's very expensive therapy. Like, very expensive,
yeah,
therapy.
That's it. Well, that's it, exactly. And I think the meme was, you know, it was written on top of it. The most expensive way to deal with your, like, to avoid therapy, right? All men all avoid therapy, kind of thing. I was like, I'm not anti-therapy. I think, so I think that, like, yeah, okay, that's, it's always stuck with me that. I think, oh, God, that's really bad. And at the same time, I think, well, God, fuck, art's so fucking boring without any of that stuff, you know? It's just fucking dull. I think you need, not problems, but you need to have something to say. I mean, you know, it's like, otherwise you're just making a documentary, right? I mean, you need something with a bit of layers, you know? And I think ultimately, if you have something you're trying to explore yourself, putting it through art helps you, but it also helps tell a more interesting story. And I think a more relatable one. And I think that, you know, maybe that's just part of it. I think you can go to therapy too, right? You don't have to just not go to therapy and make films instead. But yeah, I think it's a good thing to work with. It's like writing a song, right? Same thing. oh my god, she left me, I'm so sad. That kind of shit. But in a film form. That's my answer.
You gave me another good bridge, because I was going to say I found the score in the film to be quite beautiful. Can you tell me a bit about the composer and how you arrived to what is now the score in the film?
Nice. Oh, I'm glad you liked it, man. I think, yeah, it took a long... This was a real roadblock for me, because I think this was somewhere where, you know, I've got a background in kind of music from my family, but not film score music. And I've always loved film scores, and I needed to get it right. So it took me ages to find the right person. The road was difficult, and worked with some really lovely people that really helped try and pull it together, but they weren't able to do it. And yeah, anyway, I had Joshua Swesda contact me quite a while before I actually chose him, because I didn't know him, and he messaged me and my company just kind of asking to get involved. I looked at his stuff was amazing, and you know, he did stuff with the BBC, and he does a lot and does video games, and super diverse guy. And yeah, the more I thought about it, I was like, I think this is the guy for the job. It's just one of those things where you don't know someone and they approach you. There's like an instinctive suspicion. yeah. But I met up with him, and you know, and he has absolutely just killed it. I mean, he smashed it out of the park, and he brought his art to the table, and he put his love into the film, and you know, he believed in the project, and he did a really good job. And so when I left Lao, we did like a load of sessions with national musician there that plays a load of folk instruments, that plays in the national orchestra there. Again, this is like, was part of this journey of when we were doing those documentaries for Toyota out there, it was all like music based and classical music based out there, and it kind of like, I don't know, it all just fed into the same space. So we did a couple of sessions where we recorded local old instruments, so we've really like added all these incredible Lao instrumentation into the instruments into the composition as well. And then we have a string quartet, and Josh wrote all the double Josh. So, but wrote all the you know, all this incredible music. I think there's 20 pieces of 20 stems of music, which is a lot. It's a lot of work, and he did a great job. There's a scene where they're by the campfire, and it's kind of like just before the third act really kicks in. Or it's like at the end of, I think it's the end of the second act, and the at the campfire, and it's like a top-down shot, and then this beautiful singing comes in, this local Lao. Did you remember that bit? This beautiful vocals kick in. That singer is so funny. She came after work, and she like is fully. I've got this video recording of her singing in Lao. We did all that remotely, like only like a month ago, to be honest, and she was fully dressed in her like communist outfit, just came from work. She's also in the army and she's there singing all this beautiful stuff. But I think the video game element that the video game experience he has made him really diverse, and also able to like adaptable, I think. So I love his work, really excited to work with him again. And he's a bit of a genius, actually. It's kind of cool, and he lives in Bangkok, so he's he gets the region, and he's been to Lao a few times and stuff. So, he was the right choice.
Nice. Can you tell me a bit more about how it was the experience of shooting in Lao? How did you have to deal with the government, the local government at all? Or how was that like shooting on, because obviously you shot all on location.
Yeah.
So how was that experience like?
Not too bad, man. I think... the Lao government are great. They were pretty easy to work with. I mean, like anywhere, you know, money talks. You kind of have to pay for stuff, but that's understandable. And you have to get the script approved by the government. So the government is Lao government approved script, which is important if you want to get it over the line. Otherwise, you won't be allowed to film there, basically. So that's important. So there were so many things like that I was like, well, this is probably where this project stops now, you know. Oh, okay, no, we're through. Next stage. Oh, this is probably where this project stops now, and then through to the next stage. So they're pretty helpful, though, and I think, you know, it worked out really well. I think more people should shoot films there, and I think the team we worked with, Lao New Wave Cinema, that's what they're called, and they're incredible. I would highly recommend working with them, especially for an indie film, but it's fine. Other people can make movies there now that I've made my film there. But yeah, the lovely people, and the, you know, the government's fine. I think during the pandemic, it was a little bit, there's stuff I can moan about a lot, but there's no point moaning about that. Also, no one likes to talk about the pandemic. It's boring, isn't it? Bored of it now, aren't we? So yeah, no, it's totally fine. It was okay. I think, you know, there's lots of incentives to shoot in that region, especially Thailand as well. You know, there's a lot of incentives to shoot down there as a company, or you know. But yeah, no, it was not too bad. I think just random bureaucracy, but you get that everywhere, hey?
Sure. What are you doing now? Or what are you looking at for the release of the film?
So this is a bit that's like really new to me, and I think there's many routes you can go. Ultimately, distributors are going to take a huge chunk, and this seems to be for a few like particular reasons, right? So firstly, the contacts, but I have a lot of those contacts too, which makes me feel like I should distribute it myself, and then it's media lawyers essentially, which I also have access to. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, we'll see what happens. I have quite a few distributors that are interested now. The guys that are distributing The Big Lebowski are looking at it, who contacted me, which is random, but kind of cool. I'll be down with that. That's cool. But you know, in reality, wait for it to do the festival circuit, see what it gets. That's going to really change its trajectory quite a lot. So we have to wait and see. That stuff I'm putting on hold for now. Right now it's festival premiere, and then we'll go on to next set of festivals, and then distribution, that'll kick in straight after the premiere.
Nice. I have one like final question. You talked a bit about it earlier, but did you ever like get that feeling like during the production that this isn't happening? Did you ever feel that sort of like, just like,
okay,
that?
Yeah. So, I mean, that happened so many times, Steve. Like, I can't explain. So, first one was we spent like months getting the right lens for the camera that we had, because ultimately it's a bayonet mount. It's like a old mount. It's not even like your usual mounts of PL and EF now, and this is a bayonet mount. It's like some random old camera mount, let's just call it that. And we got this beautiful like first ever Super 16 Cook cinema lens that we spent a long time getting and refurbishing for this very particular camera. And the day 2 days before, like literally 48 hours before we're flying out. And bear in mind, I've got no budget left at this stage. It's like everything's accounted for. And I was just like, I can't buy another lens, basically. But the DOP left the lens on the tube in London, on the underground, and it was gone. And I was like, okay. I was like, maybe this is fate. Maybe we should just not go. I was literally like, if this doesn't happen, I think I'll just cancel the shoot, because I feel like it's better to stop now before we even begin. And you know, it seems like a small thing, but it just felt like one too many things for me to deal with at that point in time. And luckily, he somehow picked it up in Brixton Station. Someone had handed it in, and the guy teased him, pretended that they didn't have it. And then the DOP was crying. Like, I don't know if he wants me to say this. He was crying at the station, because it was a lot. We put a lot of love and time into all of this, man. Like tests and, you know, just so much stuff. But yeah, so that was the first time. Second time was when the camera broke down 10 days in, and we're like almost at our furthest point in the north. And I was just like, this is just like a curse, a fucking curse. We're never getting out of this. And somehow, with my amazing team in Bangkok that I've worked with various times before, they sourced me an SR3 for a good cost, which we got driven up over two or three days, and we got that camera and we continued shooting, and we were only 2 days behind the whole production.
This is the camera you had to smuggle across the border.
That's the, yeah, exactly. That's the one we had to smuggle across the border and bring up to the
Where did you get it from? Bangkok.
So they had to drive it to the north of Thailand, smuggle it over, drive it to the north of Laos. And we only, I think it took 3 days to get back into product, into principle. Yeah. And then we were 2 days over. I made a day back.
So it took them, it took them 2 or 3 days to get the camera from Bangkok to where you were shooting, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
what was that? What was that like?
Stressful, man. Because I was just like, I also had like some funding pull out, and that's when I had no money and no camera. But I'm making a film.
And you were 10 days into shooting, right?
Ten days, yeah. So we're like almost, we're coming to the halfway point. We had one more town north to go to that we can only get to by boat, which is where the mother is, right?
Okay.
That's where all her scenes are. And so we had to take this last, we're shooting there, and then we had this last trip up. And I knew that both physically and mentally, that was my mountain. I was like, if I can get to that halfway point, it's literally all downhill from there in a good way. It's like, we've got to the peak of the mountain in terms of the amount of days shooting, halfway through all this fucking story, and we're halfway through the actual shoot days, and it's like we're on our way back home. And I can psychologically be like, you know, this is good. We're over the halfway mark. But God, it felt like a battle, man. Absolute battle. And then I started to enjoy it again when we got back to Vientiane, like the in-between kind of times, in between shooting and stuff. But yeah, it was a slog, man. Talented, lovely people, but it was tough. But I would do it again. But with someone else's money. Basically. But yeah, man, no, it was good. What did you think of the film then?
Yes, I thought it was very good.
You liked it?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was like, I liked the... I jokingly tend to say that I like boring movies that make you sad afterwards.
That was one of these.
Well, no, it didn't make me... No, but it was like... It's because it has this kind of like... it's not slow-paced, but it's very like... I'm trying to find the right word. Like, it's meticulously paced, right? It's not like...
Yeah. It's not slow, but you feel at times that... I think it ebbs and flows. And I think that's kind of like the right... You know, because it's not an action film. It's not a...
It's pretty atmospheric.
I wanted to write that line.
Yeah. It's pretty atmospheric. You know, I think you utilize the landscape and, you know, the location. There's some very also beautiful shots inside the temple.
Yeah, man. The
way they capture the sunlight on, like, the floor when they're...
That wide shot near the beginning with the sweeping. It's my favorite shot in the whole film.
Yeah. There's also one very, like, really good... I was wondering, actually, did you use a crane or something? Like, there's, like, an overhead shot of, like, the fishes. It seems like you're quite...
The bridge. Do you remember the bridge?
Yeah. I imagine it had to be something like that.
Yeah, man. That shot's so good. Yeah. That's, again, one of my favorite shots in the film. Like, just... And the music's so nice at the moment as well. It's like...
Yeah. And I watched
It's just like, how did these millions of fish just decide to come here for us? It was like, just all the pain was for these small blessings. Mm. And a lot of them were, like, through animals and stuff. I'm not really a religious guy or, like, believing in any of this kind of stuff, but... We were constantly blessed by, like, animals, it felt like, you know. Like, even that dog in the river, and there's just, like, always these animals, like, coming into the scenes randomly, you know.
Yeah. And I watched it on my... I watched the 4K version on my TV, which has very good color reproduction.
Nice.
So there's some, like, scenes that I remember, like, there was one where it's, like, it's just, like, a shot of, like, on the side of a road, but it's, like, all green, and there's, like, a couple of, like, red flowers, or, like, some...
Oh, plants. Yes. Is it just when the truck is coming up?
Yeah. And it's very, like, striking.
That's cool, yeah. It's weird, isn't it? That shot's, like, not anything special in particular, but those red plants really pop.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
So there are...
And there's,
there are,
like, butterflies everywhere. Did you notice all the butterflies like, randomly, like, joining them when they're running away? When they're being chased, like, these butterflies just start following them and stuff. It's, like, so many butterflies. I've never seen so many butterflies in my life.
Yeah.
It's insane. I think there's a theme, bit of a theme of water as well throughout the film.
Sure.
Which is
obviously kind of there's that there's a dream sequence where the mom is in the lake, right? She's standing in the in the lake, and the she's river. Like she's all red, like it's shot in.
Yes.
It's one of the few like sequences that's not like shot, you know, naturally. Like it's not like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I bet that probably looked quite cool.
It did, yeah.
On your screen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, yeah, you know, I think it's the only place I think we could have got away with like creative kind of freedom there. You know, it's a dream, right? So we just play with it a little bit. And we just wanted it to stand out a little bit. But yeah, man, no, you know, I'm happy with it. I think it's what I planned on making, basically, you know? And I think for a first film, I think it does the job. So yeah, I'm excited to show more people.
And I do think it's unique because it doesn't feel like a movie that was made today. It feels like a movie that was made in the 70s. It's really weird. It's like almost bizarre because it feels so. Yeah.
But even like my approach was that like in terms of like the camera language as well. It's very classic. It's like, you know, wides are on tripods and then wides are on sticks and. The rest is kind of handheld, right?
Yeah.
And there's just so many great films from the 70s that were shot in that way.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like that.
That one about that girl that just goes off, like, backpacking on her own in the US? And she just, like, kind of hangs out with these random people, so in the 60s or 70s. Do you know which one I mean?
Mm.
What's it called? I did watch that film you recommended before I went, Alice in the City?
Yeah, Alice in the City. It's a German film. City. Yeah.
But there was another film that I watched, this American one, which is just like, oh, damn. I can't remember. But yeah, there was a lot of those kind of like low-budget indie like road movies. Yeah.
It's a very, very, very weird comparison, but it kind of gave me vibes of like another road movie, which is Easy Rider, which was also shot similarly.
I love Easy Rider so much, man. I love that film. So
it's a good film.
And it also, again, feels very, like...
It's very laid back. It's kind of like...
Laid back. And not too... It doesn't define things too much. Because when you over-define shit, it takes away the poetry, you know?
Mm.
You've got to have breathing room for your mind to come to those conclusions. But I think I tried to ride the line between that style of filmmaking and kind of classic, kind of like modern narrative structures and stuff, because I still wanted to kind of show people that I can tell a story that kind of people can digest and not be like, what happened, you know what I mean? So I tried to kind of ride the line between kind of having enough narrative beats for people to kind of attach themselves to it like Ticks, or you know, kind of look at it a bit open-ended as well. But yeah, man. Happy days. Well, it's been fun to talk about it. Right. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for coming on to this exclusive podcast.
The exclusive podcast that I am part of.
Yes.
Anyway, so this is episode 3. This is cool. I had to change it up. And we're going to, we're going to do some more episodes anyway, right? But this is like a Satu exclusive.
Yeah.
And we're going to stay tuned for like the kind of festival circuit and the premiere and stuff, and the distribution bit comes next, so I'll keep you up to date with that and see where that goes.
I'm looking forward to seeing it in proper cinema as well.
In a cinema, man. Yeah. That'll be so fun. Hell yeah. So I'm doing a friends and family screening at the BFI on the 6th of December. Which I need to send you the invite for. It's not the premiere, it's a private screening. That's critical, otherwise they won't premiere it anywhere.
Oh yeah.
But it is. It's literally just for crew and friends and family and stuff. But the BF, my friend at the BFI is getting the cinema for me.
Nice.
For free, which is good because I've got no more money now after making this. Dude, try and get over on the 6th. That should be the plan. But yeah, we'll go into let's leave anyone that's listening. We'll let them go. They can go before we hit the hour mark.
Thank you for listening.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Speak to you there. Thanks, man. Ooh.